Thank you. Good to be here again. We're going to look at the life of Joshua. I've been doing a few studies just for the fun of it of the Old Testament patriarchs. And we're going to take a group to Israel in a couple of weeks. And so it's good to review the places and events again. So I'm doing some of the patriarchs. We do this every time. This will be our 14th trip, I think. Done an overview of Abraham. Isaac didn't really go anywhere, but Jacob and Judah and those that are relevant to the land. Well, Joshua is really significant in all of that because Joshua is the guy that conquered the land. So I did a little bit of an overview of it, and then we filled in some of the blanks. Now, what I want to do this morning is look at the history and geography of Joshua, and then make some applications. And the paper you've got is the applications we're going to look at. So the history and geography we're gonna do. if you have a blank piece of paper and a pen, you might want to try to do this. I have our people draw out maps all the time. The geography is very important because it shows that the Bible is not based on some mythical idea. It's not just somebody's story. It's not Zeus and Aphrodite on Mount Olympus. This has happened. These are real things that happened in real places in real time history. If you're drawing a map of Israel, first thing we do is what we call the J, which is the Mediterranean coast. And we've got the Sea of Galilee up here, and we've got the Dead Sea down here. And skinny that up a little bit. And then the Jordan River running between the two. There's three rivers out here that kind of define the Transjordan. This goes up to, we've got the Yarmouk, the Jabbok, and the Arnon River. Down here we've got Moab, here we've got Ammon, Gilead, and Old Testament Bashan, which is the Golan today. The most significant city, we'll come a third the way across here, or two-thirds the way in, is Jerusalem. You always got to get Jerusalem on your in your bearings. And then from the bottom of the Sea of Galilee, kind of down to the Jabbok River here, we've got the Carmel Ridge. And on the north across from the bottom here, we've got the Nazareth Ridge. So this is the Jezreel Valley. And this kind of defines the difference between Galilee and Samaria, and then from Jerusalem south is Judea, the tribe of Judah. So that's our basic map of Israel. Now, we're going to put in some other cities here. We're going to put in the ones that are significant to Joshua, and then we'll kind of go through his history. First of all, let's put in Jericho. Jericho is it's east, but a little bit north of Jerusalem. And then between Jericho and the river is a city by the name of is a location by the name of Gilgal. There's no tell there today because Gilgal was a tent city, and there was no buildings made there. So we don't know exactly where it is, but it's between Jericho and the river somewhere. If you come straight across from the Jabbok River, about a third the way in here, actually kind of in a north line with Jerusalem, you have the city of Shechem. And halfway between Shechem and Jerusalem, approximately, we have Shiloh. Sometimes there's an H on the end of it, sometimes there's not. You do see some different spellings with these words, which I kind of like because I can't spell worth a hoot, so it gives me an excuse. But it's because there are no vowels in the Hebrew language. Hebrew is all consonants. So sometimes different vowels are used. The Masoretes in the 900s put vowels into the text, but they're never part of the original. And in Israel today, they don't put any vowels in. It's just consonants. All the words that you see on signs or advertisements or whatnot, you just have to know how to pronounce them. Shiloh. Now, if you go partway between Shiloh and Jerusalem, we're going to cut it in half again here. You have Ai. And that I can spell. Ai is spelled Ai. And if you can remember Bethel is right next to Ai. If they're kind of like twin cities. Bethel was named the house of God. Beth means house. El is of God. Jacob named it that when he had the dream of the angels going up and down from heaven on the ladder. Bethel, and that's right next to Ai, but Ai is significant of Joshua because it's the second city he captured. Now, if you go a little bit west of Ai, there's a city called Gibeon. Now, Gibeon is a city that's significant for Joshua. There's a Gibeah, which is just north of Jerusalem where Saul was from, so it just adds to the confusion. But we're interested in Gibeon, because Gibeon is where the sun stood still in the sky for Joshua to finish his battle. So Gibeon is what we want to put in here. Moses died on Mount Nebo, and Mount Nebo is right over here. It's right off of the edge of the Dead Sea, so we'll put Mount Nebo over here. This little area here, there's a little flat area in here, and it's called the Plains of Moab, which is a little confusing because it's not in Moab. Moab's down here, but it's called the Plains of Moab, which was where the Israelites gathered before Joshua took over from Moses. Moses died, God buried him in the Plains of Moab. The one other place, I may have forgotten something, we'll find as we go along, about partway between Mount Hermon and the Sea of Galilee, there's a city called Hazor, or Hatzor. The Hebrew letter is usually done with a TZ, Hatzor, kind of a hard sound, which was the last city that Joshua captured in the north. When he took the land. So, first of all, I want to do a brief overview of the life of Joshua, and then we'll go through and I'll read some passages and we'll just go through it a little slower. First of all, the first time we hear of Joshua is when he's 40 years old. Now, I don't think I'll draw that map. After Moses led when Moses left Egypt, remember Moses' life is in 3 40-year chunks. He grew up 40 years in Egypt, then he killed the Egyptians and fled out. At 40 years of age, he went to Midian. That's about the time Joshua was born. Joshua was 40 years younger than Moses. So he was born somewhere just about that time. When Moses came back 40 years later at the age of 80, Joshua was 40. Moses, of course, led them out across the Red Sea on dry land. But before they got to Mount Sinai, they were attacked by the Amalekites. And it says Joshua was put in charge of the army. Now, it's the first time we hear about him. We have no other introduction to him, but all of a sudden he's put in charge of this army. We don't know what he did in the first 40 years of his life, but it must have had some military experience. He may have been part of the Egyptian army or something. He had some military experience because they immediately put Joshua in charge of the battle. That's the first time we hear of him. And this is the battle where when Moses holds the staff up, they win, and when he puts it down, they lose. So they got to hold his arms up for the battle against the Amalekites. And then from then on, he's the assistant to Moses. He's with Moses most of the time. He goes to, they go up to Mount Sinai, where they're, he receives the law and so on, and Joshua's sort of not quite with Moses, but always around and close by. At Kadesh Barnea, he represents his tribe of Ephraim with the spies that go into the land, and he and Caleb are the only ones that say they should go in, so they wander in the wilderness. Joshua was with him. When they come out of the wilderness, Moses is 120 years old, and Joshua is 80 years old. And that's when Joshua takes over at 80 years of age. Joshua comes into the land, leads the people into the land, captures Jericho after they march around it, camps at Gilgal, captures Jericho after they march around it once a day for once for 6 days, and then seven times on 7 days, and they blow the trumpets and people yell and the walls fall down. Then he captures Ai after first being defeated because Achan broke the ban and stole some stuff from Jericho, and they had to straighten that out. Then he takes, and the Ark of the Covenant is sitting at Gilgal. Then he takes it for a ceremony up at Shechem, which Moses prescribed, which is amazing because Moses was never in the land. But he knew about this at Shechem. You've got Mount Ebal on the north and Mount Gerizim on the south. And those hills come right down together, and there's a kind of a pass that goes through there, which is the city of Shechem. They wrote the law. They painted some stones white and wrote the law on the stones on Ebal, made a little sanctuary on Mount Ebal. Moses prescribed that they put the ark in that valley and the people be gathered on either side. So Joshua takes care of that, but comes back to Gilgal. Then he's visited by Gibeonites, and they deceive Joshua. They come with torn clothes and all dirty, and they say, "We're just a small band of people. We come from a long ways away, and we want to make a deal with you, and so that you don't wipe us out." And Joshua, that's his probably his biggest mistake. He does not check them out. He does not go to God about it. They make a deal with them. They make a covenant to protect the Gibeonites. Well, they're just from up the road in Gibeon. When the king of Jerusalem, called Jabez at the time, but the king of Jerusalem, Adonizedek, hears about Joshua, he organizes all of these small kings of these villages together to fight, and he says, "We're going to attack Gibeon because they got to deal with Joshua." So they cap Gibeon, attack Gibeon, and Joshua takes the army all night and marches to Gibeon and defeats them. And this is where he prays that the sun stand still in the sky in Gibeon in the Valley of Ajalon. The Valley of Ajalon runs right out to the sea out of Gibeon, where he defeats them. Then he comes down and defeats a city called Lachish, which is down here, goes down to Kadesh Barnea and Gaza. The Gaza Strip sits over here, and captures the south. Jabin, king of Hazor, who is the main guy up in the north, the head of the Canaanites up there, he does the same thing that Adonizedek did in Jerusalem, organizes all the kings up there to go to war against Joshua. And so Joshua goes up there and defeats them and burns Hazor and destroys the city, burns it with fire. So now Joshua has captured the land. Then he comes to Shiloh, and he moves the Ark of the Covenant to Shiloh and sets up the tabernacle, the one that Moses built in the wilderness at Shiloh. And the Ark of the Covenant and the tabernacle sat at Shiloh for over 300 years. So Shiloh becomes the new capital. The conquest of the land takes about 7 years. Joshua is in the land for 30 years dies at 110. And towards the end of his life, he goes up to Shechem, and we have this passage that we read where Joshua says, choose whoever you like, but as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Joshua dies at 110, and they bury him in Ephraim. It's right kind of in the center of Ephraim. Today it's just north of the city of Arbel. We go past his grave every time we go there. Actually, the Jews have now started a pilgrimage to there, that they go there once a year, and it's in the West Bank, so the Palestinians have figured that out, and now they've set up stands where they sell water and whatnot, and to the Jews that come there for the pilgrimage, but they still make a pilgrimage to Joshua's grave. So there's our big overview picture. Now we'll look at some details. I've got some scripture here that I'll just read along the way. So the first thing, that we're going to go back and do this whole thing again, is what we're going to do in a little more detail. We've got the big picture. Joshua comes in the land, takes over Jericho. It takes over from Moses. Jericho, Ai, ceremony, Gibeon, the south, and then the north. Okay, so that's the big overview. I talked about Joshua overwhelming the Amalekites with the edge of the sword. That's in Exodus 17. He's with Moses. Exodus 24:13 says Moses arose with Joshua, his servant, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. So Joshua was sort of with him. At Kadesh Barnea, he and Caleb are the only ones that say they should go in. Joshua says, if the Lord is pleased with us, he'll bring us into the land and give us the land. When Moses dies, and they're gathered together here in the plains of Moab before they cross into the land, God commissions Joshua, and he's in Joshua 1:6-8. So some have this as a memory verse. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people the possession of the land which I swore to their fathers to give to them. And then verse 8, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that's written in it, for then you'll make your way prosperous, and then you'll have success. A common memory verse. So this was given to Joshua before they left and crossed the Jordan. This, I don't think I mentioned, we're talking 1400 BC now. So this is 400 years before David. 1400 BC, in the 1400s. So then Joshua leads them across the Jordan River on dry land, and they establish their first headquarters at Gilgal, and he's 80 years old at the time. Joshua chapter 3:15-16, they went, and when those who carried the ark came into the Jordan, and the feet of the priests carrying the ark were dipped to the edge of the water, for the Jordan overflowed its banks in the days of the harvest, that the waters were, which were flowing down from above, stood up and rose in a heap. So they crossed the Jordan River as Moses had crossed the Red Sea. Of course, the Jordan River is not as big, but it dried up. At any rate, they went across the river. And then they camp at Gilgal, and God gives them instructions of how to capture Jericho. And they destroy, with the exception of Rahab and her family, who helped the spies that Joshua set out, they utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, ox, sheep, donkey, with the edge of the sword. When we come to application, this is, I think, the dominant thing we've got to keep in mind. Of all of the people that Joshua killed, I would guess, and I don't know any way to count it up, that Joshua killed more people than anybody in the Bible, or ordered them to be killed, or was part of their being killed in war. So then he first lost, remember, at Ai because of Achan stealing from Jericho. But then he captures Ai, and in Joshua 8:25 it says, and all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000. All the people of Ai. So another 12,000 people are killed in Ai. Then he goes to Mount Ebal, which is, he goes between Ebal and Gerizim at Shechem. It says, Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, in Mount Ebal on the north side of Shechem. He wrote there on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel, and all Israel with their elders and officers and their judges were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The stranger as well as the native, half of them stood on in front of Mount Gerizim and half in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given. So a huge number of people now gathered around the Ark of the Covenant for this ceremony, part of them up on the, backed up on the Gerizim and part of them on Ebal. Then in Joshua chapter 9, so they go to the ceremony, and then they're back to their temporary headquarters at Gilgal. And we read in Joshua chapter 9, when the Gibeonites and the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they also acted craftily. I'm skipping some of the verses here, but and they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, and they said to him and the men of Israel, we've come from a far country. And they go on and talk about how they're just poor and traveling. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. So now he's got an oath with the Gibeonites. But when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard about it, he gathered together all the kings of the towns of the area and went against them. And Joshua prays in Joshua 10, 12 and 13, Joshua spoke to the Lord, O sun, stand still in Gibeon, and the moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day, which allowed Joshua, of course, to finish the victory. Then he goes down to Laish, and Lachish captures the city of Lachish, and on into the south, into the Negev, into Kadesh Barnea, and all the way around Gaza. Well, having heard about all of this, Jabin, king of Hazor, gathers the people in the north. And Joshua goes to war with them. In Joshua 11, 10 and 11, then Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor and struck its king with the sword. For Hazor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms, and they struck every person who was in it with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. So now he does the same thing up in the north that he's done in the south. Then in Joshua 11:23 we read, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Joshua, and Joshua gave it for an inheritance to Israel according to the divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. Then in chapter 18 of Joshua, first verse, we read, then the whole congregation of the sons of Israel assembled themselves at Shiloh, and they set up the tent of meeting there, and the land was subdued before them. Verse 10 says, and Joshua cast lots for them in Shiloh before the Lord, and Joshua divided the land to the sons of Israel according to their division. And then we have this final gathering in chapter 23 of Joshua. It came about after many days, when the Lord had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side, and Joshua was old and advanced in years. We move to 24:1. Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem, called for the elders of Israel and the heads of their judges and their officers, and they presented themselves before the Lord. And this was where, in verse 15, at Shechem, that Joshua says, as for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. Verse 26 of 24 says, Joshua wrote these words in a book of the law of God and took a large stone and set it up under the oak that was there in the sanctuary of the Lord. And then in 24, he dismissed the people, each to their inheritance. Now, let's look at some applications. And this is the sheet that I gave you to look at so we can kind of think of these. And if you have any questions or comments, I'd like you to make those. I'm a teacher, not a preacher, so I like to have discussion. And so anything that you can think of. We'll make some applications from this just to think about it a bit. We'll do some out loud thinking and see what we can come up with. As I mentioned in the first little paragraph here, I think the glaring statistic in the life of Joshua is all the people he killed. Wiped them out, men, women, child, left no one who breathed, killed the animals as well in many cases. I think that's the key thing that has to govern our thought in applying the book. So my first observation to make an application, we should note that the Canaanites, descendants from Noah through Ham, were cursed from the time of Noah. These Canaanites that he wiped out were descendants of Ham's son Canaan. In Genesis 9:22, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father, told his two brothers outside, so he, that is Noah, said, "Cursed be Ham," and goes on and makes a curse of Ham. So Noah, after they get back in the ark, Noah plants a vineyard, harvests the grapes from it, and gets drunk, and he's laying in his tent, throws his covers off, he's naked, and Ham comes in, apparently just kind of makes fun of him, and his other two sons come in and cover him up. Well, Noah, as a result of that, curses his son Canaan. And these are the Canaanites that are in the land. So it's the fulfillment of that curse that he gave, Noah gave. So my application is God keeps his curses. We like to say God keeps his promises. Yeah, even when they're curses. Sometimes including those of his patriarchs as well as his blessings. For example, God said the future of the earth is a tribulation period before the second coming of Christ and his millennial reign. After that, the earth will be destroyed. All the green earth strategy in the world is not going to prevent the upcoming tribulation and the ultimate destruction of the earth. We should take care of the earth as best we can, but we should not think we can control its future. I take care of my car because right now I'm driving it, but that doesn't mean I think I can preserve it forever or determine its future. God's going to keep his curses as well as his blessings, and he's told us what's going to happen to the earth. That we're going to face a tribulation period. Christ is going to build a kingdom and then he's going to wipe it out, Peter says, destroy it with intense heat. Now, you can join all the green movements you want. It's not going to change that. God's going to bring about his determined future. So that's my first kind of application. Now, the second thing is that the Canaanite tribes were extremely wicked people. They practiced idolatry, male and female cult prostitution. Male cult prostitution meant homosexuality. When God promised the land to Abraham's descendants, he told Abraham they'd be enslaved and oppressed 400 years, which is probably the Egyptian bondage. Then he said, in the fourth generation, they'll return here, for the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. That's an amazing statement to me, that God says to Abraham, well, your people are going to be 400 years out of the land, and then they're going to come back, and they're going to destroy the people in the land. But we're going to wait 400 years, because these Amalekites, which are disgusting people, are not disgusting enough yet. We're going to wait until their iniquity is complete. They've come to the place where I'm no longer going to tolerate them, and then you're going to wipe them out. And this is what God does. He did the same thing at the flood, and the same thing with Sodom and Gomorrah. He waits, and he waits, and he waits, and he tolerates, and he waits, and he waits, and he waits some more. And then he gives them a warning and waits some more, and then he says, that's enough, and wipes them out. That's the same thing he's going to do with this earth. You look around and you say, what's with all this disgusting evil? Well, it's not going to last, but God's going to wait. He's going to give them time. He's got people he's bringing to himself, and then he's going to say it's enough. And that's what he did here. These people were terrible people. These people practiced infant sacrifice, killed babies, not as many as we do with abortion, but they killed babies, sometimes even just had babies so they could sacrifice to Moloch, God, and so on. So these are nasty people, and God is bringing about their judgment. My application was, see the Canaanites as sin in your life. If you leave some of it in your life, it'll grow over time. If you leave a little parts alone, they'll grow up to destroy you. So the first part of that Canaanite destruction is see the Canaanites as your own sin. If you leave sin in your life, it's going to be like the Canaan. They're going to grow. We'll let the children live. We'll leave these little sins alone, and they'll grow and develop and destroy you. So see them like that's the sin in our life, to be utterly destroyed and wiped out. The second thing is don't let ungodly ideas get mixed with the Word of God in your mind. God says, I don't want you being like these people. I don't want you following their gods. I don't want you intermarrying with them. I don't want you thinking like they do. But that's what we do. We mix together the world's ideas. We have things like, where's my list here? Theistic evolution, progressive Christianity, a gay-friendly church, defining love as tolerance of sin, declaring pride to be good. Just a few examples of the things when we don't wipe out the Canaanites in our thinking. So I would apply it to our sin nature and to our bringing the world's ideas into our life. A third area that I looked at for application is Joshua was doing what God was doing. God told Moses, I'll bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and I'll give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. My application, what God's doing today is making disciples of all the world. I put Gentiles, but Jews as well, but everyone. Jesus Christ is building his church. If we want to be part of what he's doing today, Paul said we're ambassadors for Christ. As though God were making appeal through us, we beg you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. So his ministry today is he's building his church. Evangelism, discipleship, nurturing the body of Christ. Do what God's doing. And you know what God's doing from his word. And Joshua was in the middle of what God was doing, which was bringing his people into his land. Fourth thing that I put down is, for Joshua, rest from war only came by going to war, destroying the Canaanites, not compromising or tolerating them. In Joshua 11:23, so Joshua took the whole land according to all that the Lord had spoken to Moses. Joshua gave it for an inheritance to the land according to the divisions by their tribes. Thus the land had rest from war. And Hebrews 4:6 says that the Israelites failed to enter God's rest because of disobedience. Joshua gave the land peace through war, but the Israelites did not finish the job of getting rid of the Canaanites. They tolerated them, and the rest was the time of the judges. We cannot enter into the rest of God while being disobedient. If we want peace, we have to go to war with our own sin and disobedience. Life, the spiritual life, is always a battle. Go to war with the Canaanites. Peace comes through war, not through compromise. You know, the spiritual life is a battle. It's a war. When you become a Christian, you enter a battle that the non-Christian doesn't have. They don't go to war with their sin nature. They just live in it, justify it, make cases for it, and think everybody else should too. But when you become a believer and you're indwelled with the Holy Spirit, you have the conviction of sin, righteousness, and judgment. And from then on, you're at war with that sin nature. And peace, the peace that the author of Hebrews talks about, only comes through war, through that battle with our sin nature. and with the world around us. All right, do you have any questions or comments? Our life is kind of like Israel was, full of Canaanites. And you got to take them on. You can't just leave them. And God's attitude was not, well, let's see if we can be nice and then wipe them out. Somebody over here. The text makes no comment about their eternal destiny. It only deals with what was going on in the land. God says, I'm going to bring my people to my land, and I want you to wipe those people out because they're nasty people and they worship other gods. The main sin that God always talked about and pointed to is idolatry. They're worshiping other gods, and that's what they were doing. You need to understand, we all need to... people go to hell because they're sinners. We're all sinners, and God doesn't tolerate sin. We've got a holy God, and he doesn't tolerate sin. People go to heaven has nothing to do with their sin. It has to do with their receiving Christ as their Savior, because he paid for sin. Heaven and hell are a different thing if you're looking at an eternal perspective of it. God will not accept anything other than people that are holy. And the only way you get holy is through receiving Christ, who pays for your sins. We know of no other way that people get to heaven. There's an interesting, I was down visiting my daughter, and I have one daughter, I have three daughters, one of them's in North Carolina. And we went down for one of my grandson's birthdays. And she was talking about some of millennials that she was talking to. And she said the main idea is, why can't God just forgive them? Why does anybody have to be punished? Why Jesus have to die? Why couldn't God just forgive people? And this is an interesting question, and one that we need to be able to answer. The main thing to understand is God does not do that. Justice is an attribute of God. As a Bible teacher that's now a dead, a good friend of mine, Walt Hendrickson, once said, what most people don't like about God is he got there first. God makes the rules. It's his universe. And his attribute is justice. And he says, I'm going to carry out justice. But if you don't have to think very, very long. If there is no justice, there's no morality. There's no good and bad. If there's no bad, there's no good. That whole moral system falls apart if you don't have justice. And God says, I'm going to carry out justice. I'm going to balance that scale. If there's evil, then it's going to be paid for. And any sin you've got to pay for that sin. But I'm going to pay for it by letting my son die on a cross for it. So that's your... Now, the idea that God forgives sin is a liberal idea. There is nothing in the Bible that would suggest God forgives sin. God forgives people of their sin. He forgives sinners of their sin, but that's only if they come through Christ. Now, those of the Old Testament, even when Abraham believed and was reckoned to him for righteousness, it was because Christ would die for his sin. Without the death of Christ, he's lost. His faith wouldn't count for anything. It counts because Christ paid for his sin 2,000 years later. There is no other payment for sin, and there's no other way to get that, to get to God's holiness except for that of Christ. So whether these Canaanites are good or bad, relatively, is not the issue. They have to have a path to God, and there's nothing in the scriptures that tells us any way of how they had one. Now, we know God's fair and just, and so it's whatever he wants to do, he's going to do. But he hasn't given us any license to say so. You had another question? I don't know. And these people are killing each other close up. They're not shooting with a rifle across the field. I mean, they're killing them with a sword standing in front of them. And they kill thousands and thousands of them. Battle all day and all night, just killing people. It's just an amazing thing. We just don't have a concept of it. Huh? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have any thoughts. I don't have any conclusions on the post-traumatic conditions from battle. I'm just trying to think. I just finished a paper on suicide and depression, and I was trying to think if there's any tie-ins to that. In our modern world, that would be a difference, but I'd be shooting from the hip. I haven't thought that through. I don't think we're just better at diagnosing it. I think that there's some actual difference in conditions, because we don't hear anything about that all through history. So yeah, I don't have an answer for that. Good question, though. I'll think about it. Mm-hmm. We live in a cursed world. We all suffer from three things. We suffer from the curse of Adam and Eve. God threw them out of the garden, and we're not living in the Garden of Eden, if you haven't noticed. The second thing we suffer from is our own sin, our own personal sin. And the third thing we suffer from is the collateral damage of sin of people around us. Sin is always causes suffering, and it's rarely restricted to the one sinning. Just a comment on the sin you talked about with Satan. There's evil can't exist on its own. Evil has to pervert something good. The Eastern yin yang thing, where there's co-equal opposite good and evil, is just a lot of hooey. It's impossible. And if you look at the world, it's not that way at all. How they get away with that is beyond me. Evil always perverts good. You have to have something good in order to pervert it. Good is like a noun, and evil is like an adjective or something. It modifies it. You have to have a good in order to have something evil. An old example I use is if I say I have an arm and I say I have a good arm, it's the same thing. If I say I have a broken arm, well, I have a bad arm. But I can't have a broken arm if I don't have an arm. You can't break something that's not there. Evils cannot exist without good. The evil we have is the best evidence for the existence of God there is, because it means you have to have a good to break, and you can't have good unless you have an author of the good. This is why the progressives today won't talk about good and evil. It's benevolence and malevolence, or sociopaths or something, but they won't talk about good and evil. Because as soon as you talk about evil, then there has to be a good, and you can't have good without an author of it, and they don't want to go there. So there was a free sermon. Thank you for allowing me to preach that. But what you said was better. Anything else? All right. Thank you.